This is a Jerry Pippin 9/11 special. It was a near perfect plan. 9/11 was a perfect storm of interest coming together, and most of the players were unaware of the actions of the others. Who was the mastermind? Probably Dick Cheney. But this is far from proven at this time. And the why was also a perfect storm. We will begin to show you how it all came together and how loyal Americans doing their jobs were the secret of its success. We feature an overview and some witness testimony by an unwitting witness who years later came to the attention of fellow investigative reporters and associates Carrie Cassidy and Bill Ryan of Project Camelot. The story is astounding and shakes one to the very foundation of our outrage. In these programs, we plan to reveal our hypothesis on 9/11. This is a series that is in for a long haul, an uphill battle to uncover those who, in fact, are accessories to mass murder. The main thrust of the story is simply that the core group of devils who created this plan is incredibly small, but they are reaching out by using a system, the system itself, the military, in black ops, the code of conduct, need to know. And in fact, you had patriotic people doing their jobs thinking they were defending America, while in actual fact they were aiding and abetting and actually doing the dirty deed itself. We are going to present it the way we think it happened. And then we will start filling in the blanks. A very brave young woman has come forward with a key to the castle of black secrecy. And we have the credit going to fellow journalists, investigative reporters, Carrie Cassidy and Bill Ryan of Project Camelot. We have their complete interview posted here, and it's also on the Project Camelot website. We urge you to take time to listen to it. Here's an excerpt when the PFC tells Bill what she heard that morning, September 11th, 2001.
I didn't hear a thing about hijackers. Mm-hmm. I just heard that this plane was flying in a no-fly zone and they couldn't make contact with the plane or something like this. There was no communication. Protocol says it has to be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in this room when the decision was mutually made by the people talking on the phone in the room that I was in to shoot this plane down.
The voice of the woman is a lady who was in medical training at Fort Meade, Maryland. And she is talking about what happened to her by happenstance. She was pulled into service to get the brass refreshments as they had to reach a decision, and a decision fast, because Flight 93 was not answering the radio calls, and it was in the most dangerous airspace of them all. It was over a secret underground command center and near Camp David. And it looked like it was on its way back to Washington, D.C. You must remember it had been only minutes, not hours, since the Twin Towers had exploded before these people's eyes on television. And military protocol called for a shootdown of any aircraft over this airspace. Listen closely as Bill Ryan, the reporter, asked the PFC to read something he found off the internet.
You're welcome to read that to the microphone.
The Raven Rock Mountain Complex, RRMC, is a United States government facility on Raven Rock, a mountain in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. It's located about 14 kilometers east of Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, and 10 kilometers northeast of Camp David, Maryland. I've never seen this before.
Mm-hmm.
It is also called the Raven Rock Military Complex, or simply Site R. Other designations and nicknames include the Rock National Military Command Center Reservation and Alternate National Military Command Center, Alternate Joint Communication Center, Backup Pentagon.
It's exactly what you said, isn't it?
Yeah. This is the housing place of the representatives and the mm-hmm. congressmen and all of the... It's not for mm-hmm. people, it's for the government to go mm-hmm. hide. Mm-hmm. Backup Pentagon or Site RT, the latter refers to the vast array of communication towers and equipment atop the mountain. It's known as an underground Pentagon. This is fascinating.
Now to our working theory on why Flight 93 was shot down. It is our feeling, and we expect to prove this in later programs, something very, very far out, but we believe it is the truth. And that is, all the passengers from all the airplanes were diverted to someplace in Pennsylvania. We have a theory about where it was, and we'll get to that later, and why we think it was at a certain place. All of the passengers were loaded onto Flight 93, explained to them that they were on their way to Los Angeles at this 9/11 event was taking place, and then the plane was flown by remote control over an airspace that the planners knew that the military would shoot down the plane, therefore getting rid of all of the evidence of the passenger list. And the official story about Flight 93 and the passengers taking over the plane and it crashing into the ground, how did our PFC feel about that story? Listen carefully.
I remember the distinct feeling inside of me of when I saw in the news that there was this story that there were terrorists on this plane and that the people overtook the pilot and crashed the plane so that overtook the terrorists and crashed the planes themselves, and how this was leaking out as these people being heroes. And I remember the extreme moral frustration inside of me of being like, but that's not true. That's not true at all. We shot this down. And a huge conflict inside of me of knowing that the world is made or to believe this story that's not true and how people just buy this. And I felt that was really wrong. You know, why couldn't they just say, strict military protocol, is a no-fly zone. Sorry.
Now, maybe you begin to get the picture of why the officials couldn't just say they were in a no-fly zone. We didn't know. We shot them down. We were doing our duty. It's because they wanted to keep the terrorist front and center. And the best way is for no evidence of any passengers anywhere. Jim Pitzer, who has been helping us all along, with scholarsfor911truth.org, has a theory about the television pictures. Supposedly it was no telecast live of the plane hitting the first tower. But is that true? Listen to what our PFC says. She tells Bill Ryan, one of the top officers came running into the room saying he just saw an airplane hit Tower 1.
Which has never been acknowledged in the public domain.
Yes.
So he saw the first plane crash, and then he came in to tell that to you.
Mm-hmm. The department, it was just a big hallway, and he just saw this, and then he walked back, and there was maybe six or seven of us standing there, and he said, holy shit, there's a plane just crashed into the tower.
Yeah.
And a few of us were like, what, really? And we went to see for ourselves. And we were standing there watching this building on fire.
One building on fire.
Yes, and as we stood there, we saw the second plane come.
Yeah.
And then all of us, I think there was like four of us standing there at the moment. Me, him, two or three other people, two other people. It's hard to remember. Yes, and we stood there and said, holy shit, that wasn't an accident. Something's happening.
And do you remember, was there any commentary, like any newscaster saying, oh my God, or it was just a picture?
It's just a picture. And I don't, there wasn't any news, there wasn't anybody running. I mean, as far as I remember, and we didn't stay long at the TV, because it happened almost immediately that over the loudspeaker, following this, I would say within, 10 minutes, somebody came over the loudspeaker, maybe even less than 10 minutes, for soldiers to report and get their weapons.
Get their weapons?
Yes.
Because?
To protect the base.
As a standard procedure to an apparent act of war.
Yes. But not me. Not me, because I was in training.
Okay. So, and of course, George Bush himself, in an apparent slip of the tongue to the press, said that he had seen it and had said something like that he'd thought to himself, my God, that's some terrible pilot. And then he said that when he saw the second plane crash, he realized that there was an attack. That's what he said. So he could have seen
whatever
it was that you're talking about here. So it seems to be a real event. Okay. Talk us through what happened then with you and your movements that day.
So after this, the I believe it was the first sergeant of the hospital and the commander. First sergeant is in the sergeant rankings and a commander is in the officer rankings. And the first sergeant of our department gathers all together, told us that the soldiers that were stationed there, they needed to report to the command center, basically. And so all the other departments of soldiers, the nursing department, the clerical, administrational department, everybody sent their base soldiers there, and I didn't see them anymore. So basically the hospital was not fully active at that point. Everything was on hold. And those soldiers, my friends later told me that they were on 24-hour duty shifts of manning the gates and patrolling the surrounding of the area of the base. For me and the one other student that was there, our first sergeant, she was a really nice woman. She was very sweet. She offered us up to the commander of the hospital, and I believe the commander of the base, to be of service to them, because we didn't have the right to bear arms while we're in training or something like this, some logistical thing. And so she gave us to them.
Because it was something useful you could do.
That we could be useful, because nobody was in the department anymore.
Yeah.
So we needed to, okay, get rid of these two soldiers. You can take them.
Okay.
And so I remember the room that they took us into, and they told us that we were in charge of, getting coffees, any kind of snacks from the cafeteria, not cafeteria, like from the snack machines or from the place where you can get little snacks, in charge of making photocopies, because she and I had the access codes for the rooms to get in there.
Because these guys were having a meeting.
Exactly.
It was a major meeting precipitated by the fact that this event had just happened.
Yes.
And that's all you knew.
That's all that I knew. And it was made very clear to us that we were not to look at them. They sat us in chairs at the far end of the room, not facing them. And we were told to look at the wall and not listen to anything we heard. This was our direct orders. And so she and I sat there, staring at the wall, sometimes, nudging each other or talking a little bit or something, but really being very soldierly about this. And there was probably 6 or 7 men around this very large table, just like you would see in a big office somewhere. And they had this funny phone. It was like a conference call phone. And I remember them sitting there and they were talking through this phone. And it seemed to me that they were talking to one or two other places.
Did you know the names and ranks of the people in the room?
I do not know the names and ranks of the people in the room. I do know that it was, at the time, the head commander of the hospital. And I believe the commander of the base.
Right, these are two different men.
Yeah, there's the guy who oversees the hospital, and then there's the guy who oversees the base.
Okay.
And I don't know their ranks, but they were, in my opinion, they were the top ranked in the room.
Okay.
And then there were other officers and other, maybe a few first sergeants in the room as well.
And the conversation around the table was like, okay, guys, what's going on here?
Okay, guys, what's going on here? I felt stress and some unknowingness and some fear, but they hold it so well, really. They hold themselves together. And then the topic turned to a plane that was flying in a no-fly zone near to Camp David and heading towards Site R. I had no idea what Site R was, and to me Camp David was a place where George Bush went on vacation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any more than that.
And this was information that was coming in on this telephone from elsewhere.
Yes, and they were discussing this of protocol is that this is a no-fly zone. We have to take this plane down. Yes, it's a passenger plane. It needs to be taken down. It's a no-fly zone.
As you can see, she verifies the name of that underground secret base operated by Black Ops in Pennsylvania. Flight 93 turned out to be the key to the entire operation. So that was why the lies were made. And that's why the fake phone calls were made to the family. And that's how we got the media involved with Let's Roll. The masterminds of 9/11 knew the media very well. They knew how to play the media. They knew how to redirect the media away from any questions. And there were lots of questions. This has been the prelude to Program 3. On the next hour, which is Program 3, we will discuss thermite, the necessary ingredient for the planned explosion of the Twin Towers. We'll get into that video. Could there have been one that was not shown to the public? Who would have shot it? Did the CIA or someone, the armed forces, did they have a secret television crew there? Or was it a commercially available crew that was paid off later with prime time money for a special on 9/11? And then there's the Pentagon. We have witnesses who say they were ordered not to go to work that day, and others who told one story and later
Major,
told
nice
another.
To see you again. We asked you here today in an effort to clear up some things regarding your testimony on September 28th, 2001. This won't take long.
Major Cruder, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do swear that.
Major, you stated at the hearing in September that General Ackerley referred to that you saw American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001. Is that correct, Major? I'll repeat the question if you'd like, Major.
I was confused.
So, what does that mean, Major? You were confused, like, yes, you saw Flight 77, or no, you were confused, but you did not see Flight 77?
No, I did not see Flight 77.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower of a TV. You know, the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there, and didn't have much time to think about it.
More details on 9/11 next week. Stay tuned. We'll be back to wrap this up and talk about the Louisiana problem. Don't go away.
Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.
Are you curious about extraterrestrials, UFOs, alien abduction, implants, the secret space program, Area 51, and other UFO topics? Then don't miss UFOCon 2012, September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. Hear 13 exciting speakers, including Douglas Dietrich, presenting Roswell as you've never heard it before. Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, will review his new discoveries about implants. Laura Eisenhower on her almost mission to Mars. Joining these speakers are Richard Dole, Chris O'Brien, Alfred Weber, Jordan Maxwell, Michael Surratt, plus five others, including special guests Sean David Morton, Russell Targ, and John B. Wells, the Saturday night host of Coast to Coast. For more information, visit the website UFOCon2012.com. That's UFOCon2012.com.
Scepter Radio Network. Internet radio uncensored, unconstrained, and unleashed. Where sometimes the questions are more dangerous than the answers. And now, your host, Jerry Pippin.
Just when the Gulf Coast and Louisiana thought all the problems were over with the British Petroleum oil spill, guess what? They have new problems. Listen to this report from Baton Rouge Television.
This sinkhole is swallowing up more of Bayou corn. The sinkhole grew overnight.
Infrared equipment shows it's 10 to 20 feet wider. The sinkhole expanded to the north and south. A National Guard helicopter crew noticed the changes using special equipment. Some are worried about radiation in the area now. New at 6 o'clock, News 2's Adrian Pittman has more on that and what state experts say about it.
That fear comes after Texas brine was given the green light to fill its empty brine cavern with naturally occurring radioactive material years ago. Now that scientists believe that cavern maybe have collapsed, concerns swarm about what could leak out, so experts tested air samples and the mud in the sinkhole for radiation. Preliminary tests show at no point were there any detectable levels. The Department of Environmental Quality says now this is one less problem people living on Bayou Corn have to worry about.
It's a bittersweet deal. I mean, it's one thing that we don't have to worry about, which is great news, but we still have to move forward to provide the data needed to everyone involved so they can make more decisions. It's not over. This is just one part of it.
An additional water sample and soil samples were also taken today and sent to the lab for more detailed analysis. But those results should be back sometime next week. And a short time ago, the Department of Natural Resources ordered Texas brine to give daily reports on that cavern. Adrian Pittman, WBRZ, Balanced News.
Thank you, Adrian. Crews are also checking on bubbles in Bayou Corn connected to all of this. So far, there's been no change. The bubbles appeared weeks ago at the beginning of the summer. The sinkhole developed about a week ago.
The sheriff says there's 1.5 million gallons of butane ready to explode. I'm sure we'll hear more about this story. That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm Jerry Pippin. See you next week. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for more original Scepter Radio programming. Where listening uncovers the world that's been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. For questions or comments, email us at scepterradionetwork@gmail.com or visit us on the web at www.scepterradionetwork.com. Until next time.